This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In our business, we take deep dives into audio, and we come across some really interesting stuff, and we like to share it with our listeners. I think we've already established that Emily and I have both brought in some sobering pieces of audio, so why don't we get those over first, and we'll end on an up note.
Sounds good.
Okay, Emily Corwin is our Southern Tier reporter, and I should mention we also have Senior Editor Dan Barrick. He heads up NHPR's State of Democracy Unit. So, Emily, what have you got?
So I think it was 2 weeks ago, I went down to Nashua to sit in on a convening of cops and residents of Nashua, a lot of minorities, people who wanted to speak up about their experience with the police. And the Nashua Police Department has specific people on a committee to sort of improve relations there. And it was really interesting hearing people talk about their experiences being policed and experiences of cops. This is after the Dallas and Baton Rouge shootings.
I remember the report, actually, the piece that you filed.
So, these were cops who were also grieving, and it's such a complicated situation. And there was a African-American police officer, Sergeant Lakeisha Phelps, and she stood up and she was talking about what it's like to be her. And I think black cops right now are in a position to help us understand the complexity of the environment that we're in right now in a way that nobody else can, actually. And she was incredible. She had the entire room just completely silent. And, you know, there's two clips. I think we should listen to the first one, then I'll introduce the next one.
Okay, let's hear the first.
I looked at my two-year-old son, and I said, how can I explain to him that people that dress like me, because he knows that I'm a cop, he comes to the station all the time, people that are dressed like me are killing people that look like you. Not that they're not killing white people or Asians, but this is a personal, now I'm speaking as a person, not as a cop. That was my personal assessment. What do I say to a two-year-old black kid? How do I explain that to him? Fast forward until officers getting ambushed and killed. My 14-year-old white daughter came downstairs and said, you going to work today? I said, yep. How can you go to work when you know that there are people that look like you killing people that are dressed like you? This was a choice that I made to put this uniform on and protect people that look like you, 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 no matter what.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to hear her say, I'm talking to you as a person, not as a cop, like this sort of bifurcated roles.
Yeah, especially like so many times we hear cops speak in that almost very official voice that it's hard to see a person in there because they have a very important job and they're very conscious of that. For her to put that aside and say how I feel as a cop is maybe different than I feel as a person.
Right. You imagine the blue line is actually a division
right.
within her.
Right.
Yes.
Wow. And I have to admit, when you said a black police officer in Nashua, I was a little surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? She talked about her experience of feeling, she says she chose Nashua because she felt really good about the leadership and the other cops there. She's been working in Nashua, I think, for 15 years, for more than a decade. But this next clip talks a bit. She first says, you know, when she drives home, I don't know where she lives. It's not in Nashua. She says she gets pulled over, I think she said that like once a month or once every other month or something. It's kind of astonishing to think about. But then she talks about, you know, what you're saying, you know, surprised to see a black cop in Nashua, what it's like for her to be out with, you know, her fellow cops and sort of how she's perceived. So let's listen to that one.
Chief, promise I won't get written up for this. But at work with a coworker, we went to get something to eat from a store, and they're following us around. The tall white guy that I'm with, not even, he's oblivious to it. Of course I notice it because it happens to me all the time. We go to walk out of the store. Before we even get to the exit, the alarm goes off. It's the person ahead of us, of course, because we haven't gotten there yet. So we continue to walk. Excuse me, ma'am, can I see your bag? He turns to her and he looks and says, you most certainly cannot. You know she didn't set this alarm off. We haven't even gotten there yet. He saw an injustice for me and he spoke up for me where I didn't have to. We get to the car and he apologized. He said, I never would have thought stuff like that happened, no matter how many times somebody told me that their profile, that people are racist. I never thought stuff like that really happened until I saw it. It may be on such a small scale, but he was like, I'm sorry. And I'm like, well, thank you for saying something so that I didn't have to.
Emily, it's amazing tape. How much were you able to use for the story?
I didn't have a story to report immediately about this, but the tape was so good. We did a two-way with a host, and I played some of that, but not all of it. And like one thing that I hear when I listen to that is so important. I mean, not only did this white officer she was with do the right thing by speaking up himself so that she doesn't have to, but she also really reveals how he's a police officer and he's so unaware of the kind of bias that happens in, you know, to people of color all the time. And that's revealing when we, you know, look at the bigger problem of policing. And so there's just so much packed into that piece of tape.
And what are you planning on doing with it?
I mean, I'd hate to say this on the air and then not do it. And I don't, you know, there's so many things to work on, but I would love to do a profile of her if she were willing. I think that and even, you know, a few profiles of cops who are not white, I think would be really valuable. I think that they are able to see the issues from so many perspectives where most of us can't.
Right. And thank you so much for bringing that piece of tape, because it really does personify, you know, what it feels like to be on the other side of that color line that I think many of us are so unaware of or sort of take for granted. The tape that I brought is also quite heavy in some ways, but I think pretty extraordinary in its own way. You may have heard that on the first day of August was the 50th anniversary of the first school shooting at the University of Texas in Austin. And KUT in Austin and the Texas Standard put together what I thought was a pretty extraordinary documentary. It's called Out of the Blue about this. And what's interesting here is that in the 1960s, the university wanted to make this go away as soon as possible. You know, the community wanted to make it go away as soon as possible. And they talked about 100 people who never went on the record and talked about this. And just as a little sort of background, this 25-year-old engineering student, he was a former Marine, and they didn't know this at the time, but he had just killed his mother and his wife. And he brought an arsenal of weapons up to the observation deck at the University of Texas and just started shooting. And what's so interesting about this is that people had absolutely no language to talk about something like this happening. It's of the first police call.
Police operator.
Hello, this is Michael Hall at the History Department on the University campus.
Yes, sir.
There's just been a gunshot on the main plaza outside the main building, and at least one person wounded.
On the main plaza?
I mean, this calm, matter of fact, it's like they had never, ever grappled, you know, with anything. It was so implausible to them at the time.
That call today would have probably been so frantic because that person would have had any number of previous shootings in their head. And, oh, my God, how is this going to end?
I mean, it's become so commonplace. Yeah. And I actually looked into this. I kind of went into a deep hole with this whole thing from the 1930s to the 1960s. Mass shootings in America were familicide or gang-related or felony-related shootings. And it's from 1960 and beyond to today that you see a shift, this shooting in public places of innocent bystanders. And they were so ill-equipped. There are people from the television station and radio then. They just basically set up a camera, not wanting their cameraman to be killed. And so you hear the sound from this, and there is some amazing sound. There's a moment when an anchor on the news is reading off the names of those who they know are dead, and someone off mic stops him and says, "Wait, can you read that again? I thought I heard my grandson's name." And he reads it again, and it is his grandson's name. And the other guy just goes silent. It really is quite amazing. But let me just play one more powerful clip here. This guy, he's actually named John Fox, but for some reason calls himself Artley Snuff. Now, he was watching this. He saw this woman, Claire Wilson. She was 8 months pregnant. She was walking with her boyfriend. I guess they were filling up a parking meter. They were both shot. And he sees her on the mall there, and her legs are moving. So he is really afraid that the shooter is going to see that and kill her. So he decides, I've got to go out and get her.
And the tower kept chiming every 15 minutes. And I would think, 15 more minutes they've been out there. 15 more minutes. It seemed like time passed very slow. I knew I might die when I went out, but it was intolerable to leave those people laying out there. James was right next to me, James Love. James and I ran from there straight out to the people that were laying on the middle of the ball. I'd never been more scared. I grabbed Claire's ankles, and James grabbed her wrist. And we picked her up and started carrying her to safety.
Oh, I was just so happy because I thought I was going to die there. And that he came up, you know, it was just like there was hope.
Why do you think you're so fascinated by it?
Because it's sort of ushered in a new era. I mean, it's this sort of capturing a moment in American history that it was just absolutely implausible that we could be under attack on American soil. This invulnerability that is so lost to us. And also, I think the other thing is that nobody had talked about it. Like, there was no language for trauma back then. And to think about why people are affected. And, you know, just hearing that man in his voice, you know, 50 years later, it's crystal clear to him, I thought was fascinating.
Thanks for sharing.
Dan, please bring us out of this.
I have some sound that's a little less weighty. So I like this website called Awesome Tapes from Africa, which has been around for a while. It's pretty basic, but started by this American guy who I think was studying in Ghana. But he was blown away by the variety and just the volume of local music he encountered. And a lot of it just through cassette tapes that were sold on the street. Everything from traditional West African music to more, you know, sort of pop synth-based stuff, this wide variety of stuff. So he just, when he got back, he, you know, brought back as many cassette tapes as he could, put them online, and it's really sort of flowered since then. I think he now releases, digitized a lot of it, releases it, shares profits with the artists. If his goal was to give this music wider audience, a wider currency, he succeeded. One bit here is from an Ethiopian artist named Adam Haroon. And let's have a listen.
Boy, it really strikes me listening to that 30, 20 years ago, we would never have heard that unless you traveled to Africa and, you know, with a tape recorder yourself.
Right. But also when you listen to it, and that's one of the things I like about this site is, depending on how you want to listen, you can sort of hear connections to American blues music, or there's others where you can hear, you know, sort of more pop influences. It's a way, if you're really into just the sort of connections and music that's both very locally rooted but also has a kind of global presence to it, it's just a lot of fun. And you can, you know, you can go off on down a rabbit hole and discover a whole new artist or genre that suddenly becomes your new obsession.
Dan, thank you so much for bringing us up.
Sure.
That awesome. Music feels so good.
That's one thing that stuns me, you know, having worked a lot in West Africa and South Africa, you know, buying tapes off the street. The music is just indomitably spirited and hopeful. That's what we needed today.
Yeah, good. I'm glad everybody's feeling better.
Dan Baraki is the senior editor here at NHPR's State of Democracy team. Awesome Tapes from Africa. We'll put a link to that on our website. And Emily Corwin, our Southern Tier reporter, thank you so much for bringing in that audio.
Thanks.
And now you're on the hook, my friend.
Yeah, I better.
I want that profile.
I know.
That's fascinating.
Well, you can all look forward to hearing that. And we also have links to the Out of the Blue documentary from KUT and the Texas Standard in Austin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks.